I'm here to talk about Are We Alone? And in particular, this search for extraterrestrial life in the solar system and beyond. So I want to kind of go into three aspects today. I want to address what are these big questions about looking for life in the universe? What are some of these big questions? And I also, to set this up before we just go straight into where are we looking for life, I want to say, what are the big questions we're asking about life beyond Earth? And why are we asking these questions? And why does it matter? Why is it important to ask these questions? And then I want to talk a little bit about how do we go about searching. This is important to me and to anyone thinking about, you know, the amount of money that's spent to go exploring, or where do we go? It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And it turns out that there are limits to our understanding, which control very much about where we go. And then when we expand our knowledge, that then changes the whole landscape about where we go and what questions we're asking. And we almost always start right here on Earth, so we'll talk a bit about that too. And then the third part is to actually talk about some of the current and future missions and where are we going and why are we going there and what are we looking for. That's the three things I want to get to for this talk. So let's start with some of the big questions, and you might even have other ones. So in my astrobiology course, this is the first thing we do. So let's go over them. And the first one, of course, is are we alone? But, you know, who or what are we talking about here? And it turns out there's kind of two camps. There's the camp of the intelligent life, you know, the aliens that you imagine from the sci-fi movies. But then there's the whole other huge group, and I'm one of those, who studies the little tiny things, the microbes, the single-celled organisms. And that would be life, too, if we found that. And that's going to be very important because those organisms live at the absolute extremes of what we consider to be life, like the conditions under which life has flourished on Earth. And those conditions would be the types of things that we might be looking for on exoplanets. So we're interested in both the little tiny microbes and also, of course, intelligent life, which I'll get to towards the end. And I did want to say that they're not mutually exclusive, even though you think they might be, because, of course, we are made up of loads of microbes, and we couldn't survive without them. And in terms of intelligent life, and microbes are just so incredibly sophisticated in terms of evolution that they, in a way, there's a kind of intelligence around them in terms of, for example, just photosynthesis and harnessing the energy of the sun or harnessing the energy of the earth. So that's the first question. Are we alone? What are we talking about when we say, are we alone? What are we looking for? And then there's all these questions around the origin, the evolution, the distribution, and the future of life, both on Earth and out in the universe. And so there's a whole sort of category of questions around that as well. And they are around, like, how do we go from life to from non-life to life? And where and how did life's diversity all come to be? So we use Earth as our home, as our starting point. And then another thing, where to for life 10 billion years from now, when our sun turns into a red giant and not only is Earth no longer habitable, but there is no more Earth. So obviously something's going to have to happen. We're either going to all disappear or we're going to migrate. Then this amazing question, and sounds really simple, and that is, what is life? What is life? What is this definition of life? We all think we know what life would look like when we see it, right? This is non-life. This is life. That plant over there that Dan is standing behind, that's life. But when you start to take that question apart, whoa, there are over 100 definitions of life. So are we justified in looking for alien life, which we might not even know it when we see it, if we don't have a definition of life that we all agree on? Can we go out and look for it? Whoa, that is a lot to think about. That's a lot to take in. The other thing is this idea of properties or laws of the universe. So is life an emergent property of the universe? Is it inevitable that life had to evolve? Like the laws of physics or the laws of chemistry, are there laws of biology that are just going to have to happen? And I'm telling you, spoiler, we don't have the answers to almost all of this. So it's a bit bad. It's pretty crazy. This other one I really like to ask my students to think about, and we'll loop back around to this one. We've got these two hypotheses about Earth. There's the rare earth hypothesis, and there is the mediocre Earth hypothesis. And if it's rare Earth, then you are all very special. It's like all the different things that came together to make life here on Earth are so improbable. Life is so complex that it could have only happened once. On the other hand, the mediocre Earth hypothesis is the one where we're just an ordinary little rocky planet on the corner of some little solar system on a very uninteresting spiral of an average galaxy, and there are zillions of exoplanets. All those things together mean, oh my gosh, you are so not special. There's life everywhere. The universe is teeming with it. And so we cannot answer that question until we find another sample of life. And that's very, very important. But exoplanets kind of lead the way. At least we know now that they really exist. So that's something to think about. And if the mediocre Earth hypothesis is correct, then the final question that we want to ask, where is everybody? Where in the heck is everybody? That's the Fermi's paradox. And where is especially intelligent life, but any life at all, where is it? And so I'll come back around to that a little bit later, and I'm sure we can talk about that in light of particularly looking for aliens, intelligent aliens, later on. So let me now say a little bit about why we're asking this question, because, you know, there's a lot of other things we could be thinking about, and I think these questions are fundamental to help us think about the things we should be thinking about, like climate change and all of that. Humans have been wondering scientifically and philosophically about the question of are we alone for millennia. It's not some new idea that just showed up when NASA said, we're going to talk about exobiology or astrobiology. It's been around for a really long time. So I wanted to kind of set the tone a little bit. So if we go back to the 4th century BC and we see the Greek philosophers, they were asking the question. Metrodorus asked the question, it would be strange if a single ear of wheat grew in a large plain, or that there was only one world in the infinite. So that's 4th century BC, and, you know, with just looking up without telescopes, of course. And then if we zoom in to the 1500s and we see the scientist and philosopher Giordano Bruno, who wrote a book called On the Infinite Universe and Worlds, and he stated this, and it's astounding what he was thinking in the 1500s. Now, remember, the 1500s, the Inquisition. The Earth was at the center of the universe, and nobody was going to question that. And he writes this: in space, there are countless constellations, suns and planets. We see only the suns because they give the light. The planets remain invisible, for they are small and dark. There are also numberless Earths circling around their suns, no worse and no less than this globe of ours. Astounding, astounding. I mean, that is as accurate as it could possibly be. And of course, for those of you who know history, he lost his life for this. He was burned at the stake for this kind of thinking and other heretical thoughts at the time. So what we're talking about tonight in the 1500s, well, a lot of things would have happened to us. We would all be burned at the stake, for sure. There's no doubt in my mind. So he was way ahead of his time, but as accurate as we can be. Astounding to me. Now, the other thing I wanted to say, and this will, you're certainly, your parents and grandparents will know this for sure, but before the era of space probes, before we had empirical science, where you could go and observe directly, before we had that, and really accurate telescopes, both planetary scientists and the public absolutely thought that the entire inner solar system of all the rocky planets were teeming with civilizations. And this isn't just a made-up thing. This is a thing that people thought until not that very long ago. And so a famous cosmologist, Carl Sagan, said in 1978, he said, a clement or mild twilight zone on a synchronously rotating Mercury, a swamp and jungle Venus, and a canal-infested Mars. While all classic science fiction devices are all, in fact, based upon earlier misapprehensions by planetary scientists. So that's why people were afraid that there were going to be invasions and the Martians were coming. So that all changed with the beginning of the modern space age. And the first flyby of Mars by the Mariner 4 in 1965 showed a desolate landscape, cold, nothing there. Very depressing. And totally blew all that out of the water. So now it's just in the realm of sci-fi. So to come back to that question, why do we ask the questions about life in the universe? It's because we want to know, and of course, naturally, we are explorers. There's no doubt about it. That's what human beings do. So as long as there are dark skies up there, we're going to be looking up in wonder and asking that question. And speaking of dark skies, if we no longer have dark skies, then our children won't be able to look up and ask those questions. So it's not just the telescopes that are being, you know, it's difficult to see because of all the light pollution, but we need to be able to look up and see what's up there. I did also want to comment on why it matters that we ask, because, okay, we have reasons to ask, but some of the reasons why it really matters. And I want to remind you, you'll all be familiar with this photograph. The photograph of Earthrise. It's called Earthrise. It was the Earth rising over the cratered, dead, gray landscape of the moon. The photograph was taken in 1968 by the Apollo 8 astronauts who were charged with mapping the craters. There were hundreds of craters. They were mapping the craters of the moon to figure out where the landing sites were going to be for the 1969 moon landing. And that photograph changed the world. There's a great National Geographic special on it, 50 years later, interviewing those astronauts. And they did something bad. You know, astronauts were always doing things they weren't supposed to do. I'm sure you know that. They were like carrying things and then planting things on the moon and doing stuff they weren't supposed to do, golfing. I don't think they were allowed to do that. Anyway, this thing that they did was they looked up. They were not supposed to look up. They were supposed to take their photos of this boring landscape down below. And they looked up, and there was the Earth rising. And they photographed it. And back in 1968, and I remember this when I was a student, you didn't just get your photo on your phone. You had to go back to Earth, in this case, and get it developed. And if you took the photo wrong and it didn't come out, well, you never got the picture. And that photograph, thank goodness, did come out, and it changed the world because it was the icon of the environmental movement that was just getting underway in the 1960s. And people were beginning to realize we were having a global impact on this Earth. Frank Borman, who was the commander of Apollo 8, said this about the photo and about the mission. He said, what they should have sent was poets on the mission, not them. Because I don't think we captured in its entirety the grandeur of what we had seen. Now remember, only a tiny number of people have actually seen this, even to this day. I wondered to myself, well, what did the poets of the time say about that photograph? And there was a 20th century American poet and writer named Archibald MacLeish, who was writing at the time. And at the time, he wrote this: to see the earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful in its eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the internal cold, brothers who now know they are truly brothers. That is a poet. Definitely should have sent him. I'm astounded by that. And then they asked the photographer. The photographer was astronaut William Anders. And what did he say about taking that photo? And he said it best, I think. And type of an engineer or scientist type person, he said it very succinctly. He said, we came all this way to explore the moon. And what the most important thing that we discovered is the Earth. So that's why we need to go up there. That's starting to happen in real life. You can buy a ticket to get on the Virgin Galactic and get up there if you have $400,000. It's incredible. And if more people could see this, and this is known officially as the overview effect. When you go up into space and you look down on Earth, you get this perspective on the planet that is like nothing else. And a photograph just doesn't cut it. So we need more people up there, of course. And you can imagine the kind of people we need up there. Politicians, people who are making decisions for us, people who are deciding about whether or not we're going to deal with our global problems and take the Earth as the entire planet that it is, the Earth system that it is. This crisis that Dan referred to, that we all know about, it is a planetary-wide problem that will require planetary-wide solutions. So seeing the Earth from space is absolutely critical, and it is the, I think, one of the most important things that space exploration has brought us. The second thing I would say, of course, are our telescopes, and particularly our space telescopes, and particularly the James Webb. I'm not an astronomer, but the photographs, if you've been seeing them, showing us the birth of galaxies, the birth of solar systems, is incredible and necessary for us to appreciate where we've come from. So I think these are all the reasons that I really wanted to spend some time before just saying, well, we're exploring the solar system and this is where we're going. I really wanted to talk a little bit about why it's so important that we spend the money and go into space and spend the billions of dollars that it costs to put James Webb up there and the kinds of things we're going to find out with James Webb and the exploration that we're doing. So before I tell you a little bit about what's actually happening in space exploration in the solar system and beyond, I did want to make just a few comments, the second point, about the search itself. We are looking for life, and it might really be, and it probably really is, looking for something that's like worse, way worse than a needle in a haystack. And so, you know, we're looking at entire planets and trying to find the exact place where life might have taken hold. Here, you can't get anywhere here without it. It's teeming, it's everywhere, it's at all temperatures, it's in all places, it's down to 5 kilometers, it's everywhere. But what's it going to be like when we try to find it somewhere else? So I did want to just say a few words about the limits, our own limits that we have, and how we can expand those limits to asking the right questions, going to the right places. So how we go about the search depends on what we actually know at the time that a mission has been planned. So let's take the Viking missions. They happened, the Viking landers were in the 1970s, and they had this bold idea, we're going to go to Mars, we're going to land the Viking landers, and we're going to basically pour something like chicken soup on the ground and put something over the top of it and see if life eats it in the soil of Mars and gives off some gas. Some kind of anything, any sign that it's there. This is what we call extant life, life that's around right now. And so they did that, and they got, what did they find? They found nothing. They found something. They actually still debate what was found. There's people still think for sure that they found life or signs of life, and there are plenty of people who say no, they didn't. And what we do know now is that the surface of Mars is not a very conducive place to life. It's blasted with radiation. The radiation interacts with the soil on Mars and gives off these chemicals that actually destroy organic material. So it's a really bad place to look for life. You could look for life maybe under the surface, or perhaps fossil life. So I work on that aspect of, well, past life on Mars. You know, that's what I want to bring back to Earth. So what did we know during the Viking missions that was really important for constraining kind of how did we search for life? And there were, what we knew was that organic matter, organics, so not life, but carbon, which is the building block of everything inside of us, has carbon backbones. Carbon was everywhere, and the building blocks for life were everywhere. And so how do we know that? We knew that because we knew about the Miller-Urey experiments of 1950, at the University of Chicago, and we knew that because of the Murchison meteorite that landed in Australia in 1969. Those were two incredibly important discoveries that were known when the Viking landers went. So everybody went, great, lots of organics, we're gonna be able to find life, no problem. So remember, if you didn't learn this in school, we had it drilled into us that the Miller-Urey experiments were to simulate, put all the ingredients that should make life together, prebiotic chemistry, add a little bit of water, lightning, you gotta have water to have life, and bam, they got amino acids. So everybody was like, wow, we're going from really super simple to more complex. We are made up of chains of complex organic molecules. Life must be really easy to take hold. The Murchison meteorite was and is a carbonaceous meteorite, which means it's full of carbon. And so when they found that, they found that it was full of amino acids, nucleobases, you know, the bases of DNA and RNA, thousands of distinct organic chemicals, molecules. And then Carl Sagan went along and said, okie doke, if we know this, he calculated, okay, every year delivered to the Earth by meteorites and interplanetary dust particles, there are 6 million kilograms of these things delivered to Earth every single year. So there's no question that they're, the ingredients for life are here, and they've been here since near the beginning. In fact, if you want some of these interplanetary dust particles, just go up on your roof, get into your gutters, your spouting, get a magnet, and you can collect that stuff, and it's all coming from space. It's raining down constantly on us, but it's tiny, teeny stuff. So we've got those two things, but what did we not know that we know today that's important for our search for life? What was missing from the Viking missions? Two very important things are missing. We didn't know about extremophiles, microbes that live under these super extreme conditions on Earth, and we didn't know about exoplanets. So two incredibly important things we didn't know and might have changed how we went and asked the questions on Mars. Extremophiles are organisms, microorganisms that are prokaryotes. They're living under very hot conditions, very cold, very salty, very dry, very highly irradiated. Like anything they can think of that's super extreme was not known well at all at that time. So extremophiles are super important to us because if you think of all of us living in a zoo, life is in a zoo, and we've got a fence, a boundary around our zoo, and our zoo is called the biospace. This is a concept of an astrobiologist named Charles Cockle over in the UK. If we're in the biospace and we think we know what the limits of life are, everything that's in this limit is alive, and everything outside the fence is certain death. And it's extremophiles that live around the boundary of the fence. They live there. And so if you learn about extremophiles, suddenly you're finding life living at 122 degrees Celsius. You're finding life living at incredible amounts of radiation, happily flourishing with fantastic DNA repair mechanisms to fix the fact that they're being irradiated all the time. There's life that can actually live in space for a while. So a big question is, did life get delivered here from somewhere else? And that is called panspermia. So maybe it didn't even evolve here, in which case it's like the movie Contact. We don't know where they came from. And so you're stuck with this, well, we all are here, but how did we get here? We didn't evolve on Earth. So those are important things just to keep in mind that I wanted to say, that our limits are always expanding and hopefully giving us better clues as to what to look for. Okay, so the final thing then is that I want to talk a little bit now about exploration for extraterrestrial life, both the microbial type, the type that I work on, and of course, intelligent life. So that's the last few moments I want to go over that. And so I kind of have to bring up this one definition of life and one sort of approach to searching for life, and that is the follow the water mantra that NASA uses to look for life. And life being this, you know, Darwinian evolution kind of thing. So if you're going to find something, it's got to be Darwinian or else we're not sure what it is. And so NASA follows the water because, of course, we need liquid water for our cells to function, and life cannot live without water. So that is number one. So you could go beyond the solar system or you could be in the solar system, but everyone is looking for where is the liquid water or where was the liquid water in the past. And so that brings me to the topic actually of this idea of habitability and the Goldilocks zone. And you'll have heard of that. So I want to say something about solar system habitability now. Everybody has heard of Goldilocks, the little girl who ate the porridge in the bear's cottage, and she wanted the porridge that was just right. So if you think of Earth being just the right distance from the sun, so it's not too hot, not too cold, and we have liquid water on Earth, loads of it, 75% of the Earth is liquid water, 80%. Too close to the sun, too hot, bad, too far away, too cold. So that's the Goldilocks zone. Now, technically, we call that the stellar factor. So that's looking at the sun and the star's luminosity, which changes over the history of the star. So when Earth was young and the solar system was young, the sun did not shine as brightly. So that means that the habitable zone was perhaps at Earth and also perhaps even Mars, but Venus had liquid water oceans. Venus had a short time period where it was habitable. We won't want to go there now because of the crushing heat, the crushing pressure, the water's all dissipated, all the carbon is in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and they have a runaway greenhouse effect on Venus now. Earth is okay, but our Earth system is absorbing the extra heat of the sun's luminosity through time. We're doing okay for now. Mars, marginally habitable throughout its history, but when the sun gets brighter and more luminous, Mars will become, in some ways, more habitable in terms of the stellar factor. Now, there are at least two other factors, though, that people don't think about very much. And one is the planetary factor, and that is that the planet must be large enough to retain heat. If it can't retain the heat, and the heat is circulating here, we have plate tectonics, volcanism that replenishes our atmosphere. We need planetary scale factors to help maintain a planet, otherwise it dies. And so people question that about Mars. Is it really too dead to harbor any life now? So that's called the planetary factor. And then finally, the atmospheric factor. The atmospheric factor, where you have to have enough atmosphere to hold everything in to retain liquid water. And so you might need a magnetic field also, because that will push away the solar wind that is trying to erode the top of your atmosphere all the time, which has happened very much on Mars, which has a very, very thin atmosphere. So all of these things affect your habitability. So now I can finally tell you about some of the exploration. I really wanted to give you that context first so that we don't just say, oh yeah, you know, NASA or ESA or JAXA are going to these places. And I'm only going to really mention a small number, because there are plenty of things that we can talk about, and I just want to focus on a couple of them. So I'll focus on Mars and the Goldilocks zone, and I'm also going to talk about two icy worlds, moons of Saturn and Jupiter, so Enceladus and Europa. And I'm also talking about them because a lot of money is being spent and has been spent to go and explore these places, to look for life, to look for a second genesis. So let's talk about Mars first. Over time, there have been lots of orbiters, landers, and rovers. And after the Viking failure, there was a 30-year period where nothing was landed on Mars, nothing at all. And then in 1997, and I was at NASA Ames Research Center at the time, a tiny little microwave oven-sized rover was put on the surface of the planet, Sojourner, and it drove 100 meters. And it was a proof of concept rover. And after that came the bigger and bigger and bigger rovers. And so Mars is covered with rovers, and there's lots of countries trying to get to Mars, to land on Mars, to look for life. The idea of these last few missions has been, is Mars or was Mars habitable? So the is Mars habitable modern is now they're looking like under the surface. Is there any lakes under there? They've found some, they think. Near the polar ice caps where there's water, or in solid rock, can we find it? Was there life on Mars is my area, and that's going back into Mars's early history. Mars, remember, has some of the largest volcanoes in the solar system, but they're inactive. So volcanoes running liquid water on the surface of Mars, so not canals, but canyons. And canyons going into giant craters that fill with water. And this was all going on 3.7, 3.6 billion years ago, exactly at the time when life was taking hold on Earth. So an interesting question is, if life did evolve on Mars but just stopped because Mars lost its magnetic field, it lost most of its atmosphere, its water went away, so maybe evolution happened up to a point, up to microbes, and that was it. And did Mars seed Earth, or did Earth seed Mars, is it's a viable question to ask. Especially, you know, we're sitting here saying we've got Earth models, we're looking for this stuff on Mars, these microbes behind me, so we are already thinking, well, similar conditions on Mars to today and when life evolved on Earth, so maybe it happened there too. So that's the idea. And so the Mars 2020 mission from NASA is at Jezero Crater right now with Perseverance rover and Ingenuity copter. And they're in a delta, so they're in an ancient delta, driving around trying to find evidence for life. And the special thing about that, they're using organic geochemistry, and they're also taking samples. And they're saving them for the second mission that's going to come back and collect them. And this mission is overall going to cost between 7 and 10 U.S. billion U.S. dollars, which is a very interesting question. Like, is it worth it? And I'll get back to that. Because my work is on another Martian habitable environment, and these are hot springs, and that's why we work in Rotorua and also in Yellowstone, where we have extremophiles. And extremophiles in hot springs also turn to stone naturally because hot springs are full of dissolved minerals. There's a magma chamber down there, and water, groundwater circulates, and it rises, and then we have hot springs, our beautiful hot springs in Rotorua and also in Yellowstone where we've worked. And so this photo was taken on our scanning electron microscope. So what that does is it lets you look at the scale of the microbe, at the scale of the microbe, and to look at the microbe-mineral interactions to see how are these things turning to stone, how would you predict what you're going to find on Mars or in early life conditions. So these are microbial filaments with this gooey stuff, which is called EPS, exopolymeric substance, and it's the milieu that the microbes sort of, it's like snot, and they glob it out so that they can kind of control their environment because they're living in a hot spring. It's very hot. But the other thing is there's little tiny balls all over the microbes, and they are made out of silica, a mineral. And so this thing is in the middle of turning to stone. Because my fear is that we go to Mars, we spend all that money, and we're actually maybe asking some of the wrong questions. And I certainly, given that my mission to Mars was not funded by NASA, we were in the top three. They chose Jezero Crater. In my team, we were trying to go back to these hot springs on Mars, these ancient hot springs on Mars. And NASA didn't want to go because they'd been there before. And us geologists, we always go back to a place because we learn every time something new. So we always think of us as Mr. Spock with the tricorder and think of NASA as Captain Kirk, the explorer. Boo. And so, you know, I'm a little bit biased. I don't think they're in the right spot. They're going to spend a lot of money, but we do still have a mission concept to go back. It's called the Life Springs Mission, and it's a consortium of Japanese, Australian, New Zealand, and U.S. scientists, engineers, and hopefully some artists. We actually do have artists involved with our project, and so we're looking for $1 billion to fund our sample return mission, 1/10 of the cost. So this is what we're looking for. Well, what if it's life as we don't know it? What are we going to do? Gosh, that's a really important question that we really should be asking. And so that's why we need to be working together, all of us, philosophers as well, computer scientists. These are some of the people who work with us in our center. Mars is very exciting. It's Earth-like, especially in the past. And so that's why we're so interested in going there. We want to know what happened to all the atmosphere. We want to know what happened to Mars. We wanted to know what happened to Mars's habitability. So the very last things I want to just talk about then are a little bit about what happens when you get a new model and you go out to a place where there shouldn't be any life way out in the outer solar system to the icy moons of Saturn and Jupiter. And there's been some incredible studies out there. The Cassini mission run by NASA in 2004 to 2017, and now the ESA JUICE mission, which launched in April 2023, and they're going out to also study these icy moons that have a shell of ice about 17 to 25 kilometers thick, and then these oceans underneath. And they're jetting water out into space. So there's geysers in space. Phenomenal. The Hubble has seen it, and Cassini, of course, has photographed it, and it's stunning. So they've got these missions to go out because they want to figure out, given what the content and the composition of that water, it looks like there might be hydrothermal vents down there, and hydrothermal vents are full on Earth of extremophiles. So suddenly we're going out to the outer solar system that was not something we even talked about when I was at NASA before I came to Auckland 26 years ago. And so you might be asking, but Kathy, you know, this liquid water thing, like what is it doing way out there? It's way too cold to have liquid water out in the outer solar system. Well, then you've got to remember what I was saying about habitability. The habitable zone out there has been extended, but it's not the Goldilocks zone. We're outside the Goldilocks zone. It's a planetary factor. It's not the luminosity factor. So what's happening out there is that when we go out, we've got two very big planets with huge gravitational pull, and they have tidal forces that are so strong and radiation coming off of them, Jupiter especially. And so because of that, there is this extra heat that is heating up and liquefying that water. So there are missions going out there, and there's going to be, it's what, when is the JUICE mission arriving? 2031. It's far. When we want to go way out there, it is far away. I think it takes 8 months to get to Mars and years to get to Jupiter. Okay, what are the implications of finding a second genesis of life in our solar system? And if you're talking about life way out there in Europa, that's going to be a different life than what might have been exchanging over here with Mars and Earth. It's way out there, and there's very unlikely that the two would have ever interacted. So think about it. If we find life in Europa underwater, and we find life, I don't know, maybe on Mars, and of course life on Earth, that is mind-blowing. That means that the chances of finding life in other solar systems has to go up if we get at least two origins of life in our own solar system. So that really brings us to the, I haven't mentioned the Drake equation, and some of you will know what that is and some of you won't, but it changes this equation about how many, you know, civilizations might even be out there. So that means that the mediocre Earth hypothesis might be right if we find a second genesis of life, and there should be life everywhere. There are private companies and private foundations now going out to search for life beyond Earth and beyond Venus, Mars, and the outer solar system, beyond our own solar system. And that is the Breakthrough Starshot program, which is funded totally privately. And they are going to send little nanocrafts to Alpha Centauri, our next nearest solar system. I don't know exactly when, but they are seriously designing this, and they're going to use powerful lasers to shoot these tiny little nanocraft. And there are two exoplanets they're going to, Proxima Centauri B and C, to have a look and see if there's anything around those planets. So that's out of our solar system. And then my final comments are about intelligent life, yes? So we haven't found anything yet. I mean, maybe there's something lurking somewhere. It's possible. The Voyager probes are carrying, they left the Earth in the 70s and finally got out of our solar system in 2012. And they're carrying records and pictures and photographs of what life on Earth is like as a message to aliens if the craft ever encounter intelligent life. So where is everybody? And there's a lot of answers to that question, but nobody knows what the actual answer is. The reasons are maybe they're too far away. Maybe intelligent civilizations blow themselves up and they never are going to get here. Maybe it takes a long time to evolve intelligent life. It took 4 billion years for life to get from a little squiggly thing to us. So maybe it just takes a really long time, you know? Or maybe we have, there have had encounters, you know, you've heard this one. There have been encounters, but they aren't talking to us. They're watching us to make sure we're not doing stupid things. Or they're going to kill us soon, but not yet. So, yeah, we can talk about all of that. But I want to finish on the note of the UFOs. And I particularly want to mention that now they're called, if you didn't know this, UAPs. So unidentified aerial phenomena. And what I am super interested in, I was super skeptical of UAPs and UFOs, and I still have plenty of skepticism, but what I am excited about is the stigmatism of studying these phenomena scientifically has finally been removed with the congressional hearings in the US, certainly. And not all UAPs can be explained. Most of them can, almost all of them can, but there are a few that still cannot be explained and that come from reliable sources. So I guess I would say that I'm open-minded about it. I'm not really sure why they haven't literally come and just sat down and said, here we are, but I am open to the idea, but I think you cannot, it's an incredible thing to be talking about intelligent life. So we really do have to remove the stigma of studying it, and who knows what governments know. We don't know. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I'm interested in the idea that perhaps there's something out there and we better be sure that we're studying it well so that we separate the fake news from the real news. Thank you very much.